never meet again. Before you go, make this moment sweet again. We won't say.
That's Donny Hathaway, For All We Know. Born on this day in 1945, as we said before we went to break, on this day in history, as we've used our musical interludes with those musical moments on this day. We are now here with Eli Friedman, who is Assistant Professor of International and Comparative Labor at Cornell University, who also writes for Nation magazine, author of the recently published Insurgency Trap, Labor Politics in Post-Socialist China, to join us and talk to us about what's going on in Hong Kong right now. Eli, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And I'm just looking at the news this morning and just now, just a moment ago during the break, that there are thousands of people out in the street, and that the head of the Federation of Students, Lester Shum, has said that there's no room for dialogue with the chief executive, and the police fired tear gas and pepper spray. And so this, we always cover these demonstrations across the globe and see things happening, but I think that the import of this might be lost on some Americans.
Yeah, I think it's difficult for a lot of Americans to understand exactly what's going on. And to understand, you need a little bit of background about what Hong Kong is and what its relationship is to China. So Hong Kong was a British colony until 1997 when it returned to Chinese rule. But since then, it's been governed according to this approach called one country, two systems. Hong Kong has been allowed to maintain its own political, legal, and economic systems, which are separate from mainland China. But the idea, of course, was that down the line, Hong Kong would be fully integrated back into China, and how exactly these two systems would be reintegrated was a question that wasn't really specified. So, of course, mainland China is not at all democratic. It's run by the Chinese Communist Party and has been since 1949. And people in Hong Kong are now demanding more democracy. So the implications for what happens in Hong Kong stretch much further beyond the borders of this territory with only 7 million people, and of course affect all of the 1.3 or 1.4 billion people in China.
When you put it that way, 7 million people living in Hong Kong in a very tight quarters, but that their relationship to China, this huge country of over a billion people, it's not a question of numbers. This has and is going to could have a deeper, long lasting effects than people realize, given the nature of Hong Kong. I mean, we're talking about a place that was a colony of Britain's that had this huge interaction with the West for a long time, a consciousness that, in some levels, among many of the people there, may be different, in a place where it is very expensive to live, and the corporate world really has control. And there's a lot of contradictions here that can really explode back into China's face.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing that the Chinese government is so concerned about. And that's why, you know, you just mentioned that the students on the one side and the Chinese government on the other have both said, well, we're not backing down. The Chinese government doesn't want to back down because if they're sort of seen to be giving Hong Kong more democracy, right, more sort of freedom of expression, right, to vote, things like that, where they can address some of the very similar economic problems that exist on both sides of the border, well, then there's no reason why people just to the north in mainland China shouldn't say, well, hey, if people in Hong Kong can have this kind of democracy, you know, they're part of China, how come this part of China can't have that? And that could really lead to an explosive situation, which, again, is why the government is so concerned about this.
So I wonder what the dynamic is for you between the forces of the West involved in this, because China, even though it's nominally has a Communist Party in charge, is really more of an authoritarian capitalist nation than a communist nation, with giant corporations making a lot of money and very wealthy people. The strike that took place in Hong Kong of the people on the dock, run by the wealthiest man in China, that had a lot of sympathy and empathy from other citizens of Hong Kong, that this is really wrapped up in a kind of a, I'm curious what those dynamics are between, for you, the West in this? What is Britain's role? What's Western capitalist role in terms of Chinese capitalist role, and what they might be battling over Hong Kong? That's part of the story we're not seeing.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship to the West, I think, is very complicated. So far, both Britain and the U.S. have more or less stayed out of this. They've made sort of weakly worded statements. I mean, I think part of it is that Britain and the U.S. are actually not interested in a significant expansion of democracy in Hong Kong or maybe even in China. But certainly in terms of the kind of class dynamics within Hong Kong and within mainland China, one of the things that's really interesting is that all of the super wealthy in Hong Kong have come out in opposition to this Occupy Central movement.
Uh-huh.
I think it was just last week or maybe the week before, a delegation of the Hong Kong tycoons, including the man you just mentioned, Li Ka-shing, who's the wealthiest man in all of Asia, went up to Beijing. They met with President Xi Jinping. They had this meeting, and the symbolism was very, very clear, right? We stand with Xi Jinping and the Communist Party. We don't want more democracy. The system that we have in Hong Kong right now is working really, really well for us, and it is working really well for them. The problem is it's just not working that well for most people in Hong Kong, which is a society that has, you know, Hong Kong inequality within the region is probably the highest inequality of any developed economy anywhere in the world. So it's working really well for those super rich guys. It's working, you know, pretty well for the Communist Party, but it's not working that well for most people in Hong Kong.
So, and you know, right now the student leadership and others are saying that if the Chinese government in Beijing does not talk with them, then they're going to start taking over government buildings. And this kind of Occupy Central with peace and love is getting really very large, and some people call it the umbrella revolution, taking much more than students, but some workers in the middle class. So I'm curious what you think, what are the possibilities of how this dynamic might play out?
You know, it's really difficult to know, but I think one of the interesting things is the geography of these occupations. So initially, Occupy Central referred to an occupation of the Central Business District in Hong Kong, and it was called for by some university professors. What's actually ended up happening is that there's a diversity of occupations that are happening around the city, in the Central Business District, also a little bit down the road around the main government offices, but also across the harbor in the more working class part of the city in Kowloon, in Mong Kok, and also in Tsim Sha Tsui. And so this sort of diversity of occupations reflects that this is not just a sort of, you know, middle class or sort of intellectual movement at this point, and has really become more generalized, that people in lots of different parts of the city are getting involved. And so actually I think the movement at this point should be called Occupy Hong Kong rather than just Occupy Central.
Right.
In terms of how it develops in the future, you know, it's really difficult to know. That sort of early on, several days ago, there was major confrontations with the police, where the police, not the protesters, resorted to violence, using a lot of pepper spray and tear gas, batoning some people. There were some arrests, including some of the student leaders. Since then, things have been pretty calm. Now, the students and other protesters have remained really steadfastly nonviolent, although, of course, they're disrupting operation of the city. But the police have backed off a little bit, and this is a delicate balancing act for the government, because if they crack down too hard, that'll, of course, increase sympathy for the protesters and increase overseas sympathy. So they don't want to do that. At the same time, if they give them free rein, then, yeah, people might start taking government buildings, and then things become more volatile yet again. So it's hard to know how it'll develop.
Let me get a call in here before we have to take a break. And I really appreciate, Eli Freeman, you're taking the time with us here today at 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Good, Alan. Good morning.
I used to be a member of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association, and I quit back in 1970, whenever Mao died. And I was like, I've been more and more disillusioned by China. I mean, their support for the Shah of Iran, their support for the Pinochet government. I mean, I know that there was another, quote-unquote, Maoist group, Communist Party Marxist Leninist, and they immediately embraced that, and you can see where they are now. But it's really encouraging to see this revival of a democratic movement in Hong Kong. Is there any tendency to of the Mao, the former Maoist movement to be part of it, or is this basically a democratic, a new democratic movement? And thank you very much. And have a good day.
Interesting question. Eli?
It is an interesting question. You know, Hong Kong in the 1960s and 70s had a strong Maoist movement, which was very stridently anti-colonial. Of course, it's important to note that the British did not expand democracy at all within the territory. So there definitely is a legacy of people who were around then at the time that are still involved in the democracy movement today. I would say in general, certainly in general, most of the protesters do not identify as Maoist in any way, that most people are interested in the expansion of liberal democracy, electoral processes, things like that. Of course, it's worth mentioning, as I just did, that there's these major economic issues that are underlying it. And then in the mainland, it's developed in a really sort of surprising sort of way, but the people who identify as Maoist typically are, they believe in more economic redistribution, but are also usually very, very nationalist. And so it's the kind of thing that I think most foreigners are not typically sort of welcomed to that party, as it were.
So I'm looking forward to seeing talk with you more about how this may unfold in the days to come, because I mean, if China crushes this rebellion, I mean, it could go the way of Tiananmen Square. It's crushed and people are infuriated, but they do take control because of the power of that state. What are your closing thoughts on that idea?
You know, people keep bringing up these Tiananmen comparisons.
Right,
I think
right.
The parallels are obvious, but I think the likelihood of a really violent crackdown and a massacre in the way that took place in Tiananmen is pretty unlikely. We're in a different world in a lot of ways than we were in 1989. The political and economic consequences for mainland China would be pretty devastating. So I don't see that as likely right now. You know, a lot of people have been very pessimistic and say, well, look, the Chinese government doesn't back down. They're not going to back down in this case. But if you look at historical precedent, actually, there's plenty of instances when they have backed down. And I'll just give you one example as a closing thought. In 2003, the Chinese government tried to pass what they were calling an anti-subversion law in Hong Kong, which a lot of civil society groups feared would make it impossible for them to continue to operate. And so there was a huge mobilization on July 1st of that year. Hundreds of thousands of people protested. And as a result of this protest, the government ended up shelving this piece of legislation. And so they backed down. So, you know, that was just over 10 years ago. I know that the stakes are a lot higher now, but I think that with continued mobilization and dedication to the cause, which these protesters clearly have, I think they can win again.
It'd be very interesting if that happens, if Benny Tai and his Occupy Central actually get some concessions in terms of who and how they elect people. He could have a reverberation throughout China. So this would be really interesting to see how this unfolds, I should say. So Eli Friedman, assistant professor of international and comparative labor at Cornell University, author of the book Insurgency Trap, Labor Politics in Post-Socialist China. Thank you so much for taking time with our listeners today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We are taking a brief break, and we are going out with John Lennon, Imagine, in 1971. This album was certified gold, one of the great songs of all time, I think. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk to Ian Schlockman, who is running to be the next congressman from District 2. Stay with us. No hell.